let me tell you something, Mr. Bunker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead. A meathead, dead from the neck up. Meathead.
Oh, yeah, now I see what your idea of a free country is. You're free to say anything you want, but if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead, right?
That's right, because this is American land that I love.
Oh, I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do like protest when I think things are wrong.
And stand beside her. And guide her.
The right to the state is the principle upon which this country was based.
With the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England
prairies,
to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree
oceans,
with her. We demanded freedom.
With folks.
See, it's guys like you. It's guys like you who don't listen to reason. I mean, you're not listening
America,
to anything. You're totally closed-minded.
Hold on.
You're prejudiced. You're prejudiced. You're prejudiced. Not anymore. I'm leaving.
Get away from me. My home, sweet
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. James Tracy back on the show. He returns to discuss a piece that he wrote for Culture Wars magazine in the June issue, Our Humor Expresses Our Concerns, Norman Lear and the Politics of Jewish Revolutionary Laughter. James, how are you doing this evening?
Fine, Tim. Good to be here.
Very well. Thanks for coming back on the show. I think the last time we spoke was late 2020. Just before the January 6th debacle, I was checking. And we talked about media control and back then. I think that was our last time we spoke. Chris, you are a former tenured professor of media studies at Florida Atlantic University. You were purged from a position for, I guess, your personal blog and some of your research regarding, well, media manipulation, control, and also political conspiracies. So I think you're an expert on these matters, right?
That's not the university's argument, but that was certainly our argument in court and so forth. So, yeah.
So much for tenure, right?
The early victims of the cancel culture.
Yes, that was 2015.
Yeah, at least this wave of it, anyway.
You know? Yeah, and I remember when that controversy hit, and they went after the media, went after you down there. Just you had. I guess raised questions regarding a certain event in Connecticut in 2012, and then I guess they used a pretext for some sort of technicality to.
Well, I called a Jew a liar essentially, on my blog. That's what it comes right down to.
Did you identify him as Jewish when you called him a liar? You just say, hey,
No, I did not. In fact, I was generally oblivious to this, but that was the. That's the subtext of the whole thing, really. I'd say about 4/5 of all of those involved in the termination were Jewish themselves, including the federal judge. Well, we brought two cases, and both the judges were appointed to the cases were Jewish. The jury foreman in our trial was Jewish. The university administrators, the law firm that the university hired. The newspaper editors and so forth. And so I'm not saying that necessarily to suggest that I'm holding a grudge or anything. It's just a statement of fact. And a lot of these things have come to light, at least for me personally, over the past several years. And I don't believe that one could really get a fair trial in this country these days, if they want to adjudicate anything, particularly if they're a Christian and the judge is Jewish.
Yeah, one gets the starts to recognize a pattern here in many of these issues, and realize that often they're not in conflict with one individual Jewish person. It's often with the people, an organized community, if you will. And that's a distinction that many Americans are not willing to accept or admit at this point, because of what happens when they do admit that reality or confront that issue. They find themselves effectively, yeah, being canceled like you were.
Right. Well, taking a stance on gun control and suggesting that there's an agenda that's being pushed behind these mass casualty events is not the most popular sort of position to take anyway. I understand that. But there's something, I would contend that there's something larger afoot. And I was, at the time, I was somewhat perplexed, naively so, that organizations like the American Civil Liberties or Civil Liberties Union would not actually come to my aid, since this was a free speech issue. That's at least what our legal team was contending. And they were largely silent about it. There were other organizations like the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, they were as well generally quiet about it. They were going to write an amicus brief to our appeal, but all of a sudden they withdrew. And who knows what's going on behind the scenes?
Well, who controls the foundation money that you know, the grants?
Yeah, it'd be important to look at the board of trustees, and it's the same case with the board of trustees of the university where I was. You know, many of them are, they're Republican Zionists. They were rather appointed by the present governor of Florida, or the former governor, Rick Scott. And I would contend that this was my case was actually covered in the Times of Israel. There were articles that were published in the Times of Israel related to the case.
What was their interest in the story?
Well, their interest was that I had suggested that a Jew was a liar in a public forum.
Hence, proving that you're at war with the people.
Yes,
at that point.
I think that was the suggestion, and I think that I think word came down in part from that nation state to have me terminated. And it's a matter of creating a whole cacophony in the news media as well. It's targeted against you, and so it's very difficult to be able to contend with that, to address that, to defend yourself.
And this is also at a time, I don't think it was commonly used, but this is roughly within a few years that the term that I think the ADL came up with was hate speech, to as a pretext for suppressing free speech, meaning if what you say is hateful and hurtful, particularly to a privileged group, or then it can be branded hate speech, and you can be denied your right to free speech, because you don't have a right to speak hate speech. Of course, hate speech is just speech that one group may not like, and they just label it as such. You know, just like when they say fake news or false information on YouTube or Facebook or in the media.
Misinformation.
Misinformation is the term they use. Yeah.
Right. Well, but hate speech is code for what they hate. Right. It's, mm-hmm. It's something whereby they're accusing you of what they're guilty of, which is a common technique, I think.
Well, typically ADL, which is the Anti-Defamation Defamation
League. In fact, the judge in my case was a former board member of the ADL down here in Palm Beach. She was on the board of the Palm Beach Anti-Defamation League, which gives you an idea of what her political stances are.
Yeah, but I guess
so
according
she should have recused herself. But you know, we can't talk about these things in public. That would be impolite, right?
Well, that's what it is. Still impolite to talk about these things. Yes.
Oh yeah, you better not. Anyway, I didn't want to get off really on a tangent in that regard, but it's something I didn't want
to. No, it's important that people understand that is that, again, this is how they control narratives or public discourse, is by accusing people of hate speech, of being evil in many ways, of not being within the accepted around, Overton window. And then they can marginalize you and pretty much, and that's those who go off script or ask questions, and that's how it's done.
You're especially vulnerable if you are, for example, in academia.
Yeah, the very place we're told that we're supposed to respect the free flow of ideas and free speech. Yeah,
because your censor could be in the office next door to you, right, or in the department chair's office, or any number of places.
It's interesting because academia was taken over by this group, largely by appeals to things like free speech, to free speech movement. But the moment they utilized that freedom to, I guess, take over these institutions, they suppressed free speech. This was, I think it was Frank Herbert, the author, who wrote, as in Children of Dune, he says, when I'm weaker than you, I ask for freedom because that is according to your principles. When I'm stronger than you, I take away your freedom because that is according to my principles. And their devotion to free speech is very, well, it's always a question of when. You know, it's when they can use it to tear down an institution, take over an institution, they'll invoke free speech. But when free speech can be used to scrutinize their power or how their power is exercised or their corruption, then they suppress free speech and call it hate speech.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And not only that, but of course, it doesn't extend only to academe, but it extends to our very government.
Yes,
you've got AIPAC in the congressional chambers, and they take note of anyone that does not stand during the Israeli Prime Minister's address to the Joint Chamber. And they'll find someone to run against whoever might seem to be recalcitrant. And
If they don't, you don't send that pledge to support Israel and AIPAC, you get primaried, and you, all of a sudden you no longer have fundraising.
They have to sign a document too. At least you used to have to be able to, according to Cynthia McKinney.
Yeah, they'd fax it over to you the moment you first day in office.
Right. Yeah. we're a colony.
Yeah. Well, maybe tonight's discussion can shed some light on how we find ourselves in the situation we're in today. It's not this piece you wrote on Norman Lear. And of course, Norman Lear was a producer of many TV shows. The most famous, of course, being All in the Family, the focus of the article. So it was a sitcom that aired on the CBS television network from 1971 to 1979. Norman Lear and Alan David Yorkin were the producers, two Jews. It was, of course, top rated American TV show. Won 22 Emmy Awards, spun off, five spinoffs. Maude, Jefferson, The Jeffersons, Good Times, I think come to mind on that one. And Archie Bunker's Place, and also I think Gloria. Those are the, that's five. There you go. They're off the top of my head. The show was different because what it did, up until then, television, at least family, I've been pretty vanilla, I guess you could say. Non-political, apolitical. This was the first show that became what they call relevant. And they talked about issues of the day. And that's what Norman Lear said. It was a show that would introduce these controversies into the living room. Dramatize it or portray it in a comedic fashion, which is a very effective form of propaganda. They talk about issues like abortion, homosexuality, the Vietnam War that was a big issue at the time, the energy crisis, the economic problems. Of course, Watergate broke during this show, which was probably a great present for Norman Lear. Nixon was a great character to make fun of. It was particularly a gift for like political cartoonists because of his physical features. So I'll let you take it from there on this. You wrote this piece for Culture Wars magazine about All in the Family and Norman Lear. Gets into Norman Lear's history, background, his character, and his motivations for writing the show. So I'll let you take it from there.
Well, yeah, I wanted to. I thought I might see if I could get an article or two published in Culture Wars because I I plan on going out back out on the academic job market, and I figured I'd be a shoe-in if I had a few pieces published in there. I kind of grew up with All in the Family, and as I point out in the article, I did not. And I remember my parents kind of putting me to bed at least the first like season or two of the show, and saying that it was too old for me, and then I would hear them out laughing at the show. And I think it debuted on Saturday nights, and I generally caught up with the program when when reruns came on WNEW TV, channel 5 out of New York, and they ran throughout the 1970s, and really the first probably 3 or 4 seasons of the show were really the best. And you had the most kind of caustic exchanges between Archie and Michael, and the things that were examined. And I at the time I didn't really think about how the show was being created, how it was being written, or what was being suggested, or anything in the overall content. And it was not until I really delved into the program more closely that I recognized that it was based on a television comedy that debuted in the UK in 1966 and ran to the mid 1970s, called Till Death Do Us Part. And Norman Lear became aware of this through an article in Variety magazine, although there are conflicting accounts of whether or not it wasn't Bud Yorkin, his cohort, the co-producer of All in the Family, that brought it to his attention when Yorkin was visiting the UK. He telephoned Lear and said, "You won't believe this show; it's really incredible." But I think Yorkin's spouse came out and said at one point that Norman Lear, when his autobiography came out, said that he was trying to write Yorkin out of the picture almost entirely. Somehow they must have had a falling out or something. So Yorkin really does not figure as prominently in the history of All in the Family as does Lear. I guess he wanted to steal the stage for himself. There was also a volume that came out that was co-written, or probably more likely co-compiled or supervised by Lear a couple of years ago, specifically on All in the Family. So there are a lot of kind of primary documents in that too that I was able to look at and tap into. The show was always kind of a favorite of mine, and I think it still is in a certain respect, but not necessarily for the same reason that it was when I was watching it when I was a child.
You write an article that Norman Lear, of course, Norman Lear was a World War II vet, yeah. And the character Archie Bunker, played by Carol O'Connor, an Irish Catholic American, I believe, was also a World War II vet. Archie Bunker was also a World War II vet. So he was writing about this sort of the I don't think they called him the Greatest Generation yet. That's sort of a baby boomer, I think, applause to that generation, that of insecurity in many ways. But there was that generation that went off to World War II and sort of imbibed the Americanism and the triumphalism of the post-war era. And the character Archie Bunker, you write, was inspired by Norman Lear's remembrance, or at least his what he remembered of a certain priest, Father Coughlin.
Yeah, Father Coughlin, right.
Yeah, and can you touch on that?
Well, that's something he brings up in his autobiography, Charles Coughlin, who became the well-known radio political commentator in the 1930s, and he was based in Michigan, and he was originally born in Canada and Irish descent, and so he began this radio program actually to kind of support the parish, But it, 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 they were doing some construction projects at the time in the 1920s. But then, it, you know, I think by the early 1930s, it had become a national phenomenon. And one of the targets of the program was was the Bolshevism in Russia, and you know how it was impacting Europe, and how it had in many ways contributed to the rise of fascism in Europe as a reaction to the threat of communism and Bolshevism in many of the in many of Eastern European countries, as well as in Germany. And Italy and Spain, for that matter, and France. So Colgan was pointing out that you know, this was really the kind of the underlying context, the historical context, as well as the kind of cultural and ethnic context of what was taking place and all the political things that were going on in Europe at the time. And so he you know, he came up against the Jewish community at the time that took issue with his commentaries that were, of course, you know, very, very, very popular, because a lot of, you know, much of what he said, I think pretty much all of what he said was true. So it was difficult to argue with them or to take issue publicly with Colgan. You know, what they ended up doing was by the time that the United States had declared war in 1941, early 1942, they were able to shut him up. But Lear points out in his autobiography that Colgan was this, you know, he was the essence of anti-Semitism, and during his childhood, that he came in contact with him in the early 1930s. And I point out in the article that actually he was kind of collapsing a number of years together and wasn't actually being very precise. But if you talk about someone like Colgan, who's been so caricatured and so denigrated, it really doesn't matter. You know, the facts go right out the window. He's just, oh, he was an anti-Semite or whatever the case may be. I mean, this is the kind of sloppy reasoning that passes for scholarship or you know, opinion these days, or one's, you know, kind of biographical portrait. So he is someone also, Colgan was, I think, someone also who, and Lear infers this in his autobiography, someone who contributed to the Archie Bunker persona. So the Archie Bunker persona, you know, which I think is regarded as being probably the most well-known television character in U.S. TV history. He was not Irish Catholic overtly, but he was played by Carol O'Connor, who was an Irish Catholic. And he really, I think that Lear really did seek to present him as being Irish Catholic without actually saying so. So in All in the Family, they are ostensibly Protestant, and Archie doesn't really even attend.
Could that be a sort of residual fear or respect for Catholic power in the country?
I think at the time it was.
Yeah.
Because even you know, it was post Vatican II and so forth, but this was the early 1970s. I think that there was a concern to be sensitive to that, and probably would be no holds barred today.
Yeah, come a long way from that, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah. You got the nuns of perpetual debauchery, right?
Yes.
But yeah. But at the time, I think that there was a concern with being sensitive. And now to add another layer to this, in the comedy, the British comedy that I mentioned previously, that mm-hmm. I discuss in the article, Till Death Do Us Part, the patriarch, the character that Archie Bunker is based upon, is Jewish.
Yes, I didn't know that. I found that quite interesting.
And he was actually played by a Jewish actor as well. And this is something that I don't think there's no academic study that I came across of All in the Family that points this out. Of course, it's taboo, you know, could be considered anti-Semitic. But it's true, and Lear was well aware of this. He's never pointed it out either, I think, for obvious reasons. So he refashions this character to be really Irish Catholic. Okay, he's Christian anyway. And I saw a number of parallels. Well, I think that my family did back in the early 1970s. With my father and Archie, at least my mother did. And it was not that my father uttered racial epithets or used poor grammar or anything of the like, but they had similar frustrations with regard to what was going on in the country at the time, you know, feminism and the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement and all these sorts. And my father was a Kennedy Democrat. He was not he was very critical of Nixon. In an almost kind of knee-jerk way. So he was certainly not like Archie Bunker in that regard either. But and the other character, male character, is of course the son-in-law, mm-hmm. Mike Stivic, who's played by Rob Reiner. Well, in Till Death Do Us Part, the son-in-law, you have the daughter of the family, and their son-in-law lives with them as well. It's just the same case, just as is the case with All in the Family. But the son-in-law in To Death Do Us Part is he's Irish, of Irish descent. He's depicted as being, I believe, Irish. And so it's a complete switch.
Yeah, did you ever see the pilot to All in the Family?
Yeah, I did.
The son-in-law is Irish Catholic.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I recall it.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
and they changed that after they had auditioned Rob Reiner for the role.
Well, it helped that his father was Carl Reiner.
Yes.
That isn't to take anything away from Rob Reiner's performance, but yeah. So
No, not at all. Yeah. But you have this kind of a Judaized character. It's not really clear as to whether or not he's Jewish, but his name is Stivic.
That's right, Stivic, and he's Polish.
Well, he's according to the documents, his character is Estonian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I saw an article because I remember him. He used to call him Polak. So
and even that is vague.
Yeah.
So it's just Archie's characterization of him as being Polish just takes precedent over.
Which could be another way of calling someone Jewish, like someone, you know.
Yeah.
Because he is a very Judaized character. And which is a function of the show, of course.
Yeah, of course, so the tables are completely turned as far as the characters go,
mm-hmm.
in All in the Family. And there were versions of Till Death Do Us Part in a number of countries.
One thing I get with Archie Bunker, the character's idea of a middle-aged man yelling at the TV set all the time. That was something that was very common in that era, wasn't it? People glued to the TV set yelling at it.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they didn't like what they were seeing.
Right. You know? Exactly.
And unable to compute it because they were unaware of the psychological warfare that was being unleashed on the country at the time. You know?
Yes. Of which I think All in the Family was a part.
Mm-hmm.
Was an element of that in kind of a subtle way, but nevertheless it was.
One thing is, you mentioned, of course, that Norman Lear was well aware of the fact that his Jewish identity might make him a suspect. He used to talk about how it was just entertainment. He's making sure that people, a water cooler TV show that people can talk about, but at the end of the day, it's just entertainment. But nevertheless, he was a part of what this group called this Malibu Mafia, right? It was a Malibu Mafia? So.
Yeah.
And what yeah. They were a...
They were... primarily Jewish entertainment executives and producers and in Southern California, and they supported monetarily a number of liberal left causes like the defense of Daniel Ellsberg and George McGovern's campaign in 1972 and a number of other things. So, yeah, that was, it was just an informal group, really. But they were very influential in that they directed money to the causes that they supported. Now, if All in the Family was somehow classified or came under fire as being overtly political, then something would have kicked in an FCC policy called equal time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Lear's production team was aware of that, and they had to kind of massage that to a certain degree. And so when people would complain, they would respond by saying, oh, well, yes, Archie has, he's got views that are conservative. He's got perspectives that are bigoted and distasteful, and but yet he is offset by the daughter character, or by Mike, the son-in-law. So that's one way that they danced around it. But I believe that looking back on this, 50 years later, it was apparent that, and something that Lear even admits, that's what the title of the article is: Our Humor Expresses Our Concerns.
Mm-hmm.
That he was using situation comedy as a vehicle to get his political viewpoints across, and the viewpoints of the larger Jewish community.
It's interesting. This Malibu Mafia obviously would use patronage, political donations to support overt political causes, political movements, political parties, campaigns, and such. Of course, how do you quantify the patronage provided by propaganda through entertainment? That's a very powerful. It's maybe not as direct, but if you're creating TV shows, TV phenomenon, and again, this is the generation which grew up on television, that impact is going to be far greater than a Check the Right to the McGovern campaign.
Yes, exactly. And if you have the most powerful means of communication, a television network, right? There were only three at the time,
mm-hmm.
back 50 years ago, then you've got the most powerful megaphone. And not only, of course, as you pointed out a short while ago, it wasn't just All in the Family. It was a whole group of offshoots of that program. There was the Jeffersons and Maude and so forth.
Yeah, Maude would seem to be the most political, at least the most like All in the Family. The Jeffersons Good Times didn't seem to be as political.
I think they were political in the sense that they had black characters. They were the central characters, and I think that was one of the ways that they were political, or at least their producers perceived them as being political.
I think Maude was the first spinoff the following year, 1972.
Yes.
And
yeah.
That's the year she had the character had an abortion.
Yes.
This was 2 months before the Roe v. Wade decision was coming down.
Yeah, the episode on abortion aired, I believe, in November of and the Roe v. Wade decision was in February of 73. So November of 72, and then the decision was in 73. And then there were, see, that was, I think, kind of thrust upon the American public, and the public was generally unaware of that episode was going to air. And it was not until the reruns that there were actually protests, because the public that was concerned about this positive portrayal of abortion were alarmed and were able to actually mobilize for protest.
Mm-hmm. In the article, you talk about how Archie Bunker, the character, this is the first notion of bigot being used, being thrown about, being a common phrase, just on television. He's a bigot, but it's the way he's portrayed, of course, is, whether it's slang or malapropisms, his ignorance. This is the supposed to characterize the conservative. And in all of his run-ins with his other characters like Michael Stivic or the Jeffersons or whoever, he never wins an argument. He ends up always looking like somewhat like the buffoon. And this was, you write in the article, this is sort of a way to pathologize or to lower I think the status of holding those views, because they're the way they're characterized. Obviously, a character is created of his opinions in a way you never see with Michael Stivic's views, which always come across as somewhat more sophisticated. If not, you know, he may come across as didactic and impatient and petulant in many ways, but he's always, you know, he's always the smarter one. And Archie Bunker has the one that, you know, the crazy ideas would be a gun control or women's rights, feminism, you know, the war or Nixon or something.
Right. Well, yeah. So I think that the Stivic character is presented as being rational. And Archie is presented as being irrational because of the nature of his arguments, because of the his character never went to college and was a blue collar and did not used improper English and all of these things, and you know his racism. All of these things together contributed to this popular notion of bigotry that the Jewish community and Jewish mass communication researchers had been attempting to be able to get across to the American public and get the American public to actually think about and discuss since the 1940s. So the American Jewish Committee headed up a research project that was taken forward by members of the Frankfurt School, but it wasn't just the Frankfurt School. They're concentrated on, I think, quite a bit critically and with good justification that they were all European Jewish emigres. But there were a lot of Jewish emigres that were involved in mass communication proper and public opinion research that dominated the American Academy. And I know this because I went to, I was in a mass communication program, journalism and mass communication at University of Iowa, which is a Big Ten school. And we had to read a lot of the literature, even though that was not the sexiest stuff to read. It was cultural studies and other things, and as well as the Frankfurt School. But we had to read a lot of the other, the social scientific literature, and a lot of it was conducted by Jews.
Yeah, Franz Boas, Walter Lippmann, Edward Bernays.
Paul Lazarsfeld, and others. And, they were very dominant in sociology, in American sociology as well. And it's interesting that, even though we read a lot of this stuff at great length, we never discussed their Jewishness, right? It's just like they were, they're European emigres or nothing was ever discussed about the fact that they were Jews, right? And so one of the articles that I cited in the All in the Family or the Norman Lear paper was written by Andrew Joyce, came out in Occidental Observer back in 2018. And it's a very good historical overview of the undeniable and profuse kind of Jewish influence of social scientific and specifically public opinion and mass communication research in this country, really from the 1930s onward, but especially in the post-war era.
Basically, mass communication has always been dominated by Jews, right?
Yes, I think in terms of commercial mass communication and in terms of the research of it. Mm-hmm. And so Samuel H. Flowerman was the person that headed up the research project for the American Jewish Committee. And he was one of the people that oversaw, along with the American Jewish Committee, the authoritarian personality and a whole series of books pathologizing mainstream Christianity in the United States. So mainstream, European Catholicism and Protestantism and characterizing it as being bigoted. And they recognized that there was what they referred to as a two-step flow of communication, or that there was personal influence. And this is something that, for example, Katz and Lazarsfeld this very, actually this whole body of research was something that was brought back out and kind of celebrated in special journal issues about 10 or 12 years ago, as I recall, when I was still in the academy. And it was the idea that, I don't think it was necessarily a very intellectually sophisticated idea either, but this idea that their work pointed out that people form their opinion not necessarily through the mass media. There was this reference to a hypodermic needle, this like direct propaganda, direct effects, but rather it's through an amalgam of things. So it includes especially opinion leaders or other individuals that they speak to throughout the course of a day, friends, it could be pastors, you know, at their church, members, leaders of their community groups. And so it's just so it's important to, as they were pointing out, to direct your messages, not only at the masses, but also at these opinion leaders. So this whole notion, once again, of personal influence. Mm-hmm. So this was the thrust of mass communication and public opinion research at the time. And one of the things that they sought to get across was, or one of their projects was specifically, the Jewish researchers, was that we have to fight bigotry and we have to make everyone more tolerant. As if there was a problem. Well, there is a problem as far as they're concerned, because the Christianity and the Catholic Church specifically are too powerful, and they need to be subdued. And one of the ways of doing that would be through communication. And so I contend in the article that this was accomplished, whether it was intended or not. It was accomplished through texts, through programs like All in the Family, where you actually, and I saw it in my own household. I saw my mother saying to my father in kind of a laughing way, kind of a playful way, "Oh, you're like Archie." And once, you know, I mentioned this earlier, he was in a certain respect, but he was, because he was frustrated with what was going on in the political and social realm at the time, in the late 60s and early 1970s.
It's one thing to remember, as you know, that generation of adults, the World War II generation, was grappling with the social upheaval, the cultural revolution, the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. They themselves were a product of a social engineering project. Of course, you know, the trauma of the Great Depression, and then the Second World War, which is one huge giant social engineering operation, all war is. And they would again emerge from that war, come back to war, and go back to work. And women would leave the factories and start families. And you had the baby boom generation coming in. At the very time, you had a very large impressionable cohort of young people. You also have the perfection of mass communication via through television, and then electronic music, rock and roll, and all those factors into this at this time is coming together. And a lot of this just wasn't just an unfolding or a convergence of events. A lot of it was engineered, as you talk about with the study of mass communication, how it can be utilized in terms of forming public opinion. Now, it was Walter Lippmann who said the public opinion doesn't really exist by itself. It's created because sure. Most people's understanding of the world, they only have their five senses. They have to rely on sources of information. And of course, as information becomes more centralized and people become more dependent upon it, whether it's newsreels at the theater or the radio, of course, network television, which again, all the major figures of the network news, not only were they Jewish, they also came out of the Office of War Information and also the Office of Strategic Services. This was all psychological warfare. Yeah. And so when you look at it, the whole generation in the 50s is being, in early 60s, is almost like being led to this point. And you refer to the American Jewish Committee and their publication of The Authoritarian Personality, which, if I think it's chapter 23 that talks about how only way you can prevent a rise of fascism in a society is you have to Well, one thing is you have to drench it with sex and pornography and weaken the father figure, the male, the patriarchal figure. And because the more society becomes more fascist, if it's actually by most people's standards psychologically healthy, if they're psychologically unhealthy, then they're not fascist in a perverse way. It's their understanding of things. And so you could see how through a show like All in the Family, first of all, you have this idea of the foolish father figure. Remember, before that, it was Leave It to Beaver, Ward Cleaver,
Father Knows Best.
Yeah. Yeah. By the 70s, you started to see it. It wasn't complete because you had other shows that countered this time, but sort of the father, the male father figure, the male in the house as sort of a goof, a failure, yeah, a dunce, and the women and the younger people being smarter than he is. And you see that first, I think, with All in the Family, right? I mean, that's it.
Yeah, I don't think that there was a television patriarch like Archie prior to that. No, you still had Gunsmoke on a Bonanza at the time, or just prior to that. I forget when those seasons, how long those shows ran, but at least until the late 1960s, early 1970s. So the censors, the network censors too, were also careful about this. And Lear was in constant battle with the censors in terms of wanting to push the envelope and to examine these issues. I mean, he thought of them really as being the enemy in many respects.
And the idea of grappling with these issues with a half-hour TV show, where obviously the script is written, so it's not a natural, organic conversation. So whoever's writing the script is going to write it in a way that's going to, reflect his values and the way he wants it to go. So again, Archie always loses. His arguments are always stupid. They're a caricature of certain views, And so again, and you can always write in like a one-liner or quip that wins the argument. And that's how the issue is handled, which again, these issues are far more complex than a half hour, which really is more like 23 minutes with commercials, can deal with it.
Right.
Yeah. But this is where you get the idea of a very special episode of, where we take on the issue of racism. We saw this, a proliferation of these type of shows in the 80s, like on Family Ties, another popular show, which is somewhat like All in the Family, where the character Michael Keaton became more popular than the producers expected, because more people related to that character than the liberal parents, the same way that when Archie Bunker debuted, people came to actually relate more with Archie Bunker than with Michael Stivic or any of the other characters.
Yeah, so that was not the intended effect either.
Yes.
Yeah, but that did in fact take place. Right. Yes, exactly.
You Which was
the same thing. Say the same thing about the Trump phenomenon.
Right? Yeah, and again, you can see the frustration, perhaps, with the Malibu Mafia or the producers, All in the Family, with the sort of how it was reflected in politics. How people just got tired of all the 60s and all the nonsense, and there was a conservative reaction to it in the 80s. That started in the 70s, really. That started with the McGovern campaign, the alienation of particularly Catholic Democrats from the Democratic Party, which then went to the Republican Party in the late 70s and 80s. That was a Reagan phenomenon.
Right.
With that. But yeah, this idea of, again, using Archie Bunker, the vehicle, is to, and you write about this, is to sort of unwittingly Judaize the country and pathologize Christian values. So basically Jewish values become normative in the country through the vehicle of entertainment.
Yes. Right. We touched on this earlier, and one of the broader arguments of the article is that Lear was using the situation comedy as a political really as a political vehicle, and that this was confirmed in his own later activities as a creating People for the American Way and so forth.
I find it ironic that he would be unhappy with the use of television by televangelists, so-called, and the moral majority. And he didn't like the fact that they were using television to evangelize and proselytize and politicize, sort of mobilize the Christian right against this Jewish subversion, which he was full aware he was spearheading, him and his cohorts out in Hollywood. And people were vaguely aware of it. People have been vaguely aware for the, ever since Hollywood got started, actually, to go back to, as far back as Joe Breen, who pretty much said there are all a bunch of degenerate Jews out there. You don't want them controlling entertainment fair. And he had no problem naming the Jew. Because of the demographics of the country and the power of the Catholic Church, they were able to impose a production code. That changed in the 50s and 60s. And there's a very interesting story behind that, the destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods and the rise of suburbia and the psychological warfare behind that. But the idea that he would, and maybe you want to comment on this, I found it funny that he wouldn't like the idea that televangelists were utilizing television to spread their values, but he had no problem using television to impose his values or promote his values.
Exactly. Yeah, and he thought that he had to go to war with these televangelists who were really this new phenomenon that arose in the late 1970s. To the extent that he wanted to actually do a movie called Religion, I believe, to lampoon and bring down the televangelists. And because it was, I think that there was an effort here to turn back the tide to a certain degree as well. You know, even though it arose with the likes of Billy Graham and other televangelists, Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart, but he wanted to. I think that he was concerned, as you suggest, with regard to the degree of their influence. And that they would have a counter effect on what he and he was attempting to accomplish with his sitcoms. And of course, his All in the Family and the Lear family of sitcoms, if you will, were not the only ones. There was Mary Tyler Moore, which took up the issue of feminism, which was almost completely written by Jews.
Yeah, James Brooks, I think, did that one. Yeah.
And There was MASH as well, who was written and produced by Jews.
Yeah, Larry Gelbart.
Only All in the Family, but All in the Family, as I suggest in the article, was really in many ways just the most politically potent of the group.
Yeah, MASH, of course, involving the Korean War, but actually, simply say that was more about the Vietnam War, which is, by the time MASH premiered, of course, MASH was an adaptation of a movie, a 1970 movie.
Right.
And the TV series premiered, I think, 1972. And like All in the Family, it was strong for about 4 years. And then started to peter out, most TV shows are like that. It's far hard to keep the momentum going. At least the writing was strong for about 3-4 seasons with MASH, at least in my opinion. But you're right, even looking back, watching shows like MASH, the shows are... if you watch it, the way the issues are handled, the values that are promoted, very Jewish, of course, libertine when it comes to matters of sex, people who believe in moral rectitude and morality are foolish or naive, think Father Mulcahy on MASH, right? you're just fools. But it is interesting that something like Norman Lear and his creation of People for the American Way, promoting liberal ideas. They went after Judge Bork when he was nominated in 87. Sure. And of course, he's invoking America. The American Way is just complete libertinism, I guess, which is because the way the American Way is a Jewish way from his perspective. But
it has to do with cultural pluralism, multiculturalism, mm-hmm. and all of these sorts of, right, yeah.
And unlike your example, the way some of these issues were portrayed, observation is that people like Jerry Falwell didn't, at the end of the day, although they railed against abortion and called for a moral majority, and in many ways were very, very powerful politically in their day, they were also Christian Zionists. So they never really able to really directly engage the enemy in these cultural wars, so they lost.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Israel bought, I think, Jerry Falwell a jet plane. He was completely co-opted if he ever had any sort of autonomy to begin with. I think he did to a certain degree, but yeah, that's generally the case today as well with a great deal of Protestant Christianity.
Yeah, so that was just, despite their efforts, they weren't able to, again, they themselves didn't understand. Billy Graham had some interesting things to say with Nixon in private, from what I understand.
Yeah.
So.
had to recant it.
You had to but it's very simple. Is that this is something that I see in Lear, his what he writes about Father Coughlin, is that this you see this with Jews a lot, is that any criticism or recognition of their power, how the power is abused, is immediately interpreted as irrational anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Yes. Whereas there's no room to criticize them. You see this today with the ADL, where any criticism, any acknowledgement is a threatening a second Holocaust or another, you know, another pogrom or something. And they
they'll quickly become the victims,
mm-hmm.
or play the victim. Right.
Yeah. Like Father Coughlin would be talking about, the millions that have perished under the Bolsheviks and Judeo-Bolshevism, as it was referred to often in that time, because the prominent role the Jews played, organized Jewry played in spreading communism and Bolshevism in Europe. The same way, even today, if people are critical of cultural trends, whether it's the promotion of transgenderism, sexual perversion, homosexuality among children, then you point out the role that Jewish organizations, Jewish families, foundations in spearheading it, even though they brag about promoting it, then you, if you turn around and criticize them for promoting it, they call you an anti-Semite. Even though they admit to being key to these issues, to promoting these agendas, you know.
Well, I think all of this, all of these agendas somehow make them feel more comfortable, right? If we are, if our tolerance, our acceptance of these things, if they're just, we just don't question them or anything at all, then they feel somehow safer as well.
With a TV show like All in the Family, some of these issues, the concerns that people had, things like busing or integration or crime, Sherlock Holmes and family would treat them in a way, these issues, in a way, of course, which was completely contrary to reality and many people's experiences. I recall an episode where the Bunkers are robbed in their home. And the two black robbers are played by Richard Roundtree and I think the person who played on Sanford and Son, the character.
Yeah, the Lamont.
Lamont, the character. Now, these are two nice looking, attractive individuals who aren't violent. They're just intimidating, but they're robbing the house because they're poor and their families are hungry.
Yeah.
And
that was the second season, I think.
Yeah. And of course it's funny because then it involves Michael Stivic and he starts talking all the sociology crap. They laugh at him because he's pretending like he understands their plight. But then that's the Jewish portrayal of crime. Also the threat of black crime, meaning it's political in a way, the same way that the George Floyd riots were political. And so that's an interesting portrayal of crime, or again, it's somehow crime that the white people are experiencing is because of bigotry. So they're kind of getting their just desserts and they're getting lectured as they're being robbed by these people. Also another example, an episode where Edith is raped.
Yeah.
And she's raped by a middle-aged white man, not by a black guy who breaks into the house, which if you look at the crime stats, you know, it's really not, you know, it's, or when Archie is uncomfortable, the fact that his neighborhood is being integrated, the ethnic, character of his neighborhood is being changed. Mm-hmm. That episode, that's something to laugh at. Of course, we know, that destroyed a lot of neighborhoods and chased away these ethnics into the suburbs where they lost their identity, which they become, white people with no deracinated white folk in suburbia, who will then go and watch Norman Lear TV shows and become Judaized because they no longer have the ethno-religious identity to fall back on, other than consumerism or something, which isn't ethno-religious. But
yeah, they essentially destroyed the ethnic identities of so many of these groups by revamping, overhauling the metropolitan areas, right?
That was intentionally done to smash those neighborhoods because.
Well, there was all sorts of federal money put towards it too in the 1970s. So, you had people in the given communities. I mean, it happened in my own hometown, where they put a four lane right through the town. And, ruined the town. I mean, that's a microcosm, obviously, of what happened in larger cities. But revamped the downtown to where it was, nothing like it had previously been. able to foster communities and interaction, things like that.
And the idea that, you know, resistance to forced integration or busing was solely based on bigotry as opposed to, you know, real everyday concerns like crime and getting a decent education and maintaining your community. And again, that's sort of the caricature is created by Norman Lear. These are just bigoted, you know, outdated ideas. And Archie Bunker is a man who's afraid of the future. He's looking back. He can't understand what's going on. And he's just someone to be laughed at. And in the end of the day, he becomes, you know, himself becomes a better man because he's Judaized.
Yeah, this is something that Lear actually points out in his autobiography, that Archie is this character who is scared of the future and he's clinging to the past and he's frightened and so forth. So and at the end of the 12 seasons, because there were, I think, 9 seasons of All in the Family, and then it became Archie's Place, and he actually presides over, attends the bat mitzvah of his stepdaughter, I believe, her step-granddaughter. So yeah, he's become thoroughly Judaized at that point. And he, you know, Carol O'Connor talks about that character in his autobiography as well, which I believe I cite some passages from. And you could tell that Carol O'Connor is, you know, he himself, his political outlook, he's generally quite liberal.
Yeah, he's liberal. Yeah. His politics was always liberal. And of course, you know, Archie Bunker, the character, his opposition to things like homosexuality is all based on bigotry and ignorance. There's no, you know, obviously, Archie never expresses any moral, philosophical, or theological opposition, or just, you know, revulsion to its you know, crime against nature. It's just again, it's effective as bigotry, and everyone is, there was one episode I was prior to this interview, I was watching some of the YouTube clips, mm-hmm. and there's a character that's a friend of Michael and Gloria, who's a little effete, and Archie's implying that he's a homosexual, calling him a fairy. These things are, his criticism is very childish. And one thing I thought was funny was that Gloria and Michael at first deny that he's homosexual, as if it's something to be denied, as if it's an issue, which is kind of funny. So yeah. he's not. Then, of course, the sentence goes, what if he is? So what? And that's where, again, you have this idea, what they interject into the public. One thing, something like homosexuality is normalized or introduced to the public first through comedy. We mm-hmm. saw that on television. Of course, there were memos written in Hollywood to do this very thing. Mm-hmm. And one thing they do is, I think there was an article written in the 1980s about the reconstructing heterosexuality, I think is something written in some gay journal about how you condition the public to accept this. First thing you introduce to the public is the idea of indifference to it. And once you people get over people's instinctual revulsion to it and promote indifference, it's just the natural course that you can invoke civil rights and start promoting it, which where we are today. If people are indifferent to it.
Yeah, where we've been for the past few decades anyway.
Yeah, the indifference to it. Yeah.
At the same time, there's a steady weakening of the church.
Yes.
The influence of the church. Right, over the past 50, 60 years.
And of course, I mean, you create that vacuum.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's going to be filled by something. It's filled by Jewish values. Because they, and there are people, and they are organized, and they control, primarily controls the means of communication, mass communication, entertainment. And that's why, you know, whether it's advertising or TV shows or movies, and we're seeing today is sort of like an acceleration of this process, where the agenda is being pushed almost.
It's creating a new belief system. I think that's something I point out in the article. This was represented in the Dear Abby column and the two female Jewish columnists who were syndicated, who were sisters from Iowa, and Ann Van Buren, I believe, right? Dear, anyway, they were syndicated, and you know, they represented these values that were clearly Jewish, mm-hmm. in terms of you know, generally being accepting of homosexuality, not really being discerning in terms of sexual relations or anything of the like, and having an intolerance towards Christianity. So all of these things really were kind of they were being suggested to a newspaper reading public in the 1940s, the 1950s, and they were even more readily accepted, and they were reinforced by the broadcast media in the 60s and through the 70s.
Which is
so actually you have a nation that that has been effectively Judaized.
Because those who control the networks and the newspapers are overwhelmingly Jewish, at least beholden to Jewish power.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's bigoted.
There's no check on that either. If you have something like the Legion of Decency, which was very powerful in the first half of the 20th century through the 1960s. And that's something that fell by the wayside.
Any countergroup expressing a similar ethnic identity or group cohesion and using that institutional power to check the other identity, again, is pathologized, it's racist, it's bigoted, you know.
Yes.
And that's what you get with the ideas of pluralism. And this is where it's almost where they'll inject these ideas where diversity is our strength. We need pluralistic, diverse society, so there's no cohesion or homogeneity, or more importantly, therefore no organization to check a group who, like the Jews, who control things like network and banking or entertainment. And if you acknowledge that control, at least that organization, that networking, they'll use that control, which they deny exists, to destroy you.
Yes. Well, there's no homogeneity except for them, except for their mm-hmm. Jewish community itself, right? Everyone else is deprived of it. Yeah.
And this was you saw this. This is a problem that almost began immediately in the early 19th century, after you had the mass migration or immigration from Jews from Eastern Europe in the late 19th century from Russia and Poland and that area. But they gravitated towards banking and finance, and of course, early Hollywood. And we mentioned, of course, the Legions of Decency and the Hayes Code. There was some recognition of this in the early part of the 20th century, but back then you could still, identify Jewish power and not be completely destroyed for. Of course, in the aftermath of the Second World War and the narrative that came from that war, opposing Jewish power as such or naming Jewish power, you'd be considered the equivalent of a Nazi,
yeah.
And of course, their control of Hollywood and media, they would again draw another caricature, with the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. So anyone acknowledging or questioning Jewish power would be, labeled as such, and treated accordingly.
I think that whole narrative has sort of taken form up since the 1970s,
largely through Hollywood, right?
Yes.
Because most people, Americans, do see unfortunately reality through the lens of Hollywood, or
Hollywood, which encompasses U.S. television production.
Yes. And it's a show like All in the Family would perform. And again, the idea that anyone believing these values are stupid, they're ignorant, they're backward, they're fearful of the future, and it's just a question of the passage of time letting them die off, and the future belongs to us.
And it's something now that's taken for granted in our educational institutions as well, from K through 12 through the university system. You can't really examine, you wouldn't be able to discuss the topics that are discussed in, for example, my article or other things that are discussed in Culture Wars, or like publications, that just a handful of them anyway, but none of these are all taboo. It can't actually be honestly, discussed or anything of the like. So how can one contend that there's anything such as academic freedom? There's not. It's policed. It's the entire U.S. Higher ed system is, it's a disaster because of that. At least the humanities and the social sciences to a large degree, certainly history. So.
Yeah, one of the things that's, again, it's hard to people to grasp is understand really is what occurred in the 20th century, the rise of Jewish power is in America. America being a liberal society was relatively easy to infiltrate and take over if you're so determined to do that, and is the sort of the waning of the WASP elite and the ascendancy of Jewish power since the 1960s. And there's sort of been a quiet revolution that's taken over in this country. You could see it, you know, obviously they were powerful in the early 20th century because they were able to get us in two world wars. And that's what the Balfour Declaration is all about. In the 1930s, Jewish power was very influential in getting the United States into the Second World War. And that's why, you had Charles Lindbergh canceled at that time.
Yeah,
for acknowledging the role of the Jews, along with the British and the Roosevelt administration, in getting us into war with Germany, which he feared would destroy European civilization. He was pretty much correct about that. But then he was sort of canceled at the time. And then, of course, the war happens and it's over, and America is victorious. The post-war era and sort of a period of quiescence, I guess you say, in the 50s. But even in the 50s, you had things like the Kinsey Report being supported by the Rockefellers, not all Jews, but again, he's there to promote this stuff. And that sort of sets the intellectual groundwork, at least he's the academic work, to justification for the sexual revolution in the 1960s. Which you get with electronic media, with rock and roll and TV and these things, and the collapse of the production code and the rise of suburbia, antennas, TVs in every house. I think it was Father Feeney of Massachusetts who said that having a TV in your house is like having a rabbi in your house. It's a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, that was considered acceptable public opinion at the time. Today he'd be regarded as a Nazi.
Yes. I mean, I have friends who used to express these sentiments like in the 80s. I just think they were kind of backward at the time. And I look back at it, they were right, because they had sort of a common man, street smart view of Jewish power, you know, the ethnic reality, you know, sort of the truth, the reality behind ethnic identity, and how you know, if you're watching television, you're watching Jewish television.
I do attempt to address that in the article as well, and that is with the policy of Nostra Aetate, which in the early 1960s.
Okay, well, yeah, what Nostra Aetate? What was that?
Well, this was something. This was a policy that came out of Vatican II. That it sought to foster dialogue with other religious groups, including the Jews. And this was something that Jews themselves were instrumental in creating, this policy. And so part of this involved no longer blaming the Jews for the death of Christ. So deicide was something that was off the table, and now we're just going to have this dialogue with the Jewish community, the Catholic Church, in other words. So alongside this, the Catholic Church really kind of lost its teeth, because there was, if you also had a kind of no more boycotts of movie houses. And this was a very effective tool that was used by the Catholic Church and the Catholic community to protest indecency in the media, and especially, you know, people at that time went to the movies a few times a week. So it was a very effective way of protesting. There were. I think all of these things came together, and you had a Catholic Church that was increasingly weakened in terms of being able to stand up to contest the culture war, to be a real advocate for their constituencies.
Yeah, it promoted the idea that you could have dialogue with the Jews. They were the elder brothers, not as opposed to theological enemies of Christianity. And
that's at least what's that is at least what's promulgated even today from church officials and so forth. The idea that they're our elder brothers, but that's not, the history of the Catholic Church is the history pre 1960s does not take that as a given.
The idea that you again that you promote a secularized society, the traditional church teaching would say, if you do that, you're delivering them to the Jews, because again, that vacuum will create that vacuum will be filled by Jewish values who control things like modern media. There was an idea that there is something to be feared of the modern world, and Vatican II said there's nothing to fear of the modern world. We have to engage it, right, and naively. But they did have doctrines like Inter Mirifica, which dealt with media and these things. And there are some say they've done research on Vatican II, of which Nostra Aetate is a part of, I guess, is that it was taken over by Americanists, and the original idea was a much more skeptical view of American power. And so, this is the era of the Cold War, of course, and so the Catholic Church is kind of in between two materialistic empires, capitalist West versus communist East, and neither of which are congenial to traditional Catholic understanding of things. But the West seemed much more friendlier at the time for obvious reasons. They didn't have, barbed wire and concrete walls and guards keeping their people in. So the West seemed to be much freer, but it turns out the Western values, at least materialist values, have turned out to be far more destructive in the long term, as we can see now with the global homo being the agenda of the American empire. But the idea, Michael Jones has written a lot about Karl Ratzinger, who again was a German young man at the end of the war, and he was captured, of course, and his much like the German people. His mind has been under occupation since the war, and he was unable to free the German people from NATO's occupation, assuming that John Paul II was able to free the Polish people from Soviet occupation. And much of that is the narrative of the Second World War and the guilt that comes with it. And he sort of internalized it, and he effectively became an agent of Americanism at Vatican II, which steered the council in that direction. At least its interpretation, how it was implemented in the following years, but there's much debate about that.
Since his passing, I mean, there's very much aside from Dr. Jones, there's very little commentary in that regard. It's just all glowing. He was a wonderful theologian and so on and so forth. And no doubt he was, but he had failings. And in 2013 he abandoned the church.
Yeah.
He just and here, look what we have today. We've got the Jesuit Pope.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are comparing Francis to Benedict XVI, and of course that makes Benedict XVI look all the better because of the current person on the throne. St. Peter's throne right now is he's very disquieting, or at least very disconcerting for many faithful Catholics, some of those utterances and the policies that have been implemented. But you're right, this was a key moment because the Catholic Church kind of abandoned its post. This is the time, and you also mentioned Notre Dame, of course, I think in the article, right?
Yeah.
And that plays an important part in the Notre Dame's alienation from the Catholic Church and Hesburgh's role in that. Do you want to touch on that?
Well, yeah, I think Notre Dame is a definite part of Americana, and so even if it's kind of a pastiche in a way, it's still regarded as being this Catholic institution. Of course, we know that's really not the case, and it hasn't been the case since the 1960s with the Land O'Lakes, and I think that this is generally a fairly well known, probably among your listening audience. But you know, when I was growing up, that I think the knowledge of what was taking place in the Catholic Church and the politics of the Catholic Church were generally unknown to me, and they're increasingly coming to light. You know, you have Dr. Jones's work, as well as, you know, there was a book that came out last year by Father Charles Muir about the Paul VI investigation of Freemasonry in the church in the 1970s. And so all of these things are now coming to the fore over the past, you know, the past decade or two, really. But I think that if I had known that, if I had some of this information handy at the time, I probably would not have left the Catholic Church. I mean, I just came back to the Catholic Church about 3 years ago, but I, for most of my adult life, I was gone. I was not a part of it. And, that in part had to do with, the fact that, my father did not play. You know, he left in 1970 when they introduced the new Mass. He had had it. And, so the main source of his Catholic information was the Blue and Gold Illustrated, right? It was, you know, Notre Dame football's fan or magazine, fanzine, and that was it. I don't think that he took it upon himself to, you know, to investigate a lot of this either, and the actual history of Notre Dame. But there just wasn't a great deal of material out there that was actually critical of the university. But now we do know, you know, we do know this history and the fact that Notre Dame was stolen in the late 1960s. It became really generally a secular institution with a Catholic veneer, and yet it's not that at all. And my uncle graduated, I think, in 1949 or 1950 from Notre Dame. It was a completely different institution then.
It was all male until 1970, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
And St. Mary's College was the one with the, you know, the ladies went to. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the one where Dr. Jones was fired from for opposing abortion in 1979.
Right.
Yeah.
To be fired from a Catholic institution, right? A Catholic college. It's pretty amazing. So I can't really take the mantle of being an early victim of the culture war, or the cancel culture, I mean. But certainly he's the one that took the headshots very early on.
Now, he said he got the job there initially because he had a fold-up bike that everyone was enamored with at the interview. No one asked him about his positions on anything.
The MLA, I think he was talking about the Modern Languages Association. Yeah, that's got to be a cutthroat conference.
Yes, yes. So Hesburgh alienates the church. I think alienation of church property. I think Cardinal Kroll called it that. But there was never any effort. I think the Pope... I think was enamored with Hesburgh for some reason or another, and
well, he was more powerful, arguably, than the Pope.
Yeah, but the Pope gave him a ring, and Hesburgh just put it in a drawer, never put it, never wore it.
Yeah.
it's like, but the Pope, I think, obviously Hesburgh was looking for support from the Empire, from the Rockefellers, and I think he wanted the funding that came from that. And I think the pretext for alienating, putting under lay control was academic freedom. Of course, academic freedom was interpreted as, you know, freedom from the Vatican or Catholic Church, and not so much from the oligarchs, which kept the money spigots flowing into Notre Dame, which changed its character.
They wanted to be able to feed at the foundation funding trough and any other organizations that were funding research, and in order to be competitive, of course, you have to put lay your Catholicism at the door. You can't you're not able to really, so they forfeited their Catholic soul in order to be this to be a research one institution,
be a great university.
Yeah.
The working class Catholics who gave pennies or dimes to help build Notre Dame in the 20th century had it stolen from them in the 1960s.
They still got a good football program.
That's the important thing. Notre Dame football, which is so American, isn't it? So yes. American. But the of course, the relevance to this and Norman Lear and All in the Family and the Malibu Mafia in Hollywood is that, again, if places like Notre Dame had maintained their Catholic identity and protected it and used that perch to form as a sort of a counter institution to Jewish power in Hollywood, we'd have a much different country today than we have now, because there would have been some pushback and some real victories in the culture war. At the very least, they would have been restrained as they had in the first part of the 20th century. And they would have to at the very least genuflect to Christian sensibilities, which still, I think, reflect the majority of the country in many ways. But without having any organization, any leadership, it's impotent. And it just, to this day, people,
you can't, first of all, you have to take into consideration your own fallen nature.
Mm-hmm.
And have some sort of theological bearing, understanding of that, and of your own spirituality and everything. And that's just simply not fun, right? That's not cool. That's not hip. That's not sexy. So this whole, the whole propaganda, everything that the social engineering that's been put upon us over the past, half century, has that kind of allure. But this type of seduction, and at the same time you these types of things like prayer and so forth, and any kind of spiritual firmament takes effort. Who has time for that?
And there's no immediate reward for that, is there? Usually, right? And if anything, there's often suffering that goes with that, or sacrifice.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. That's part and parcel. At least if one is Catholic.
Yes, it's hard to sell that. Like you can sell a Big Mac or Coca-Cola or something.
Yeah,
but that's what they turned America into, though. That's what the whole point of this that exercise was, turning into one big vast commercial enterprise, a business, if you will, which maybe speaks to the America itself, because America's founding and it is an Enlightenment project, and with that, all the philosophical and theological errors that go with that. But the idea that you can have like freedom of religion, right? Where you can have a pluralism. And of course, the real effect of the First Amendment is to sort of, I think, is to make render religion impotent, ultimately, in its influence on society, which is why the traditional Catholic understanding of it is that the ideal society is sort of an integral society, a confessional state, if you will. That's not what America is, not what it was founded on, is what it is. But that's why America has been as a liberal empire, has been conquered so easily by very clever, enterprising men.
Well, I think that free speech protections and the First Amendment has been used in a particular way by malevolent forces.
Mm-hmm.
So that at one time the central focus of American culture in many ways was the crucifixion and the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, has now been usurped. Prayer's been taken out of school. And so what do we have? What's the really official religion? What's the Holocaust? The Holocaust has replaced the crucifixion. It's replaced Jesus Christ.
That's, and if you doubt that, this is Canada. But Canada recently passed a law last year, made it a crime to publicly question the Holocaust narrative.
Which has been par for the course for years in a number of European countries.
But there's no penalty for denying the Holy Trinity or the divinity of Jesus Christ. So whose values are ascendant in those countries?
Sure.
Yeah. Right? I mean, if you propose a law saying make it a crime to question the divinity of Jesus Christ, what would you hear from Norman Lear and his friends?
Well, not only that, you have what is referred to as Holocaust education mandatory.
Yes, and that's fairly recent, by the way, because that's just in the past 10 years. I went out when I was studying history, when I was in junior high and high school, it came up, but it was just a subpart of the Second World War. There was no emphasis on it. It was just treated as one of the many disasters of that conflict, human catastrophes. Where
I graduated from high school in the 1980s, and there was no there wasn't any discussion of it.
No.
At the same time, back in high school at that time, we still read Shakespeare and you know, the Greek myths and things like that. And they don't read those today.
Along with the Diary of Anne Frank.
We didn't read that. I don't
know. Oh, yeah. Or Elie Wiesel's book, Night, which, you know. You're right about that. Is the sacrifice of Christ on the cross has been substituted with or replaced by the collective sacrifice or suffering of the Jewish people as told in the Holocaust narrative. And so they're now, you know, this the center of our culture, as opposed to Christ. And so that's what we find. So, yeah, the Holocaust, the collective suffering of the Jews with the Holocaust has supplanted the suffering of Jesus Christ on the cross and his sacrifice, which is why, you see the laws.
That does not violate church and state, does it?
No. And now you have a national, was a conference or to devise a strategy to counter anti-Semitism, spearheaded by the White House, you know.
Deborah Lipstadt,
who she came up with the idea of Holocaust denialism or something in the 90s. The deal with
didn't she lead the whole persecution of David Irving?
Well, I saw the movie. Supposedly, she was being persecuted by David Irving.
Yeah,
she's also a lot prettier in the movie. but yeah, that's how they twist things, as if she's being hounded and harassed by him, and he's the one whose career was ruined.
Sure.
His house was firebombed and
right up there with Joe McCarthy.
Yeah. So the piece, the article again, is our humor expresses our concerns. Norman Lear and the politics of Jewish revolutionary laughter. It's in the June issue of Culture Wars. I recommend you subscribe to the magazine and read the article. It's a great article. You did a couple pieces in a row because the month before you also did a piece on Jerry Lewis, the king of comedy, right? And the role, you know, the subversive role of comedy, introducing vulgarity, breaking boundaries.
Lewis was just a very important influence in comedy, mm-hmm. in American comedy in the beginning in the early 1950s. And it was something that it was a real exploration for me because I missed him almost entirely. I was born in 1965. And so his heyday was from the late 40s through the early 1960s. And so by the time his star had passed,
he was doing telethons.
Things like All in the Family.
And but, he was doing telethons, right?
Yeah.
Jerry Lewis, yeah.
Exactly. But he was, I was really actually amazed at the amount of influence that he had at that time, beginning in the 1950s. And, you know, many of the comedy writers and the stand-up comics that are popular today and have been popular over the past several decades were influenced by him. Many of the Jewish writers and mm-hmm. comics, and including the likes of Lenny Bruce and Philip Roth and so forth. So,
and this notion of breaking the boundaries, doing obscene humor. Of course, yes. Lenny Bruce was kind of obscenity charges and this sort of shattering taboos. Now, any society is. is going to develop false idols, and humor is a good way of smashing those idols, but it's also, it can be weaponized to break boundaries and also to promote obscenity, to undermine subvert society as well.
Lenny Bruce is lionized as being this this icon of free speech in the United States today, right? Because he was the first to use that such profuse profanity and vulgarity on stage.
And the idea of confusing free speech, the penchant for Jews of confusing free speech with obscenity, at the same time suppressing political speech behind the scenes.
That's not anything that, by the way, that Jerry Lewis condoned at the time. Mm-hmm. You thought that was pushing the envelope too much. but he pushed the envelope in other ways. So yeah, that's in part what the article examines, his influence in that, in American comedy.
He married a Catholic woman.
Yes.
And had five kids, right? With her.
Six.
I'm sorry. Yeah, six.
Was one that was adopted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but they left him out of the will. He,
so it goes, yeah, it goes into that as well.
Yeah.
Comparing him, to, the Philip Roth's, Portney, and, his whole kind of ethnic hostility towards his wife, which, had really not been examined in the past, but I don't know how anyone could interpret it any other way, than this kind of just conflicted hostility towards her. And, if it were not for her autobiography, probably wouldn't have been able to easily write that, write the article. There have been really few scholarly treatments of his life. And, the best one is by Sean Levy, and I use that biography. It's a very detailed biography, but even he does not really examine their relationship in kind of a critical lens. And it's very unfortunate for her in many ways, really quite tragic, their marriage, and for the children as well. But I think that because he was, you know, he was such an icon, and in addition, he had this whole philanthropic veneer that, through the Muscular Dystrophy Association, his darker sides were really not examined. They haven't been examined as closely as they have been in the past year or two, where some of his victims of his sexual predation have come to light. Have come to the fore and have discussed their experiences with him,
which is a common, I guess, a theme or pattern we see
in Hollywood, right?
In Hollywood, yeah.
The casting couch and
yes,
yeah,
and so exploitation, you know, of young women and promises of stardom and these things. It came out a little bit with the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein, and then, you know. It was kind of then shuffled off and forgotten about what's going on. Yeah, with the Me Too stuff.
The Muscular Dystrophy Association had misgivings about taking him on as a spokesperson in the early 1960s because they were aware of his philandering. I mean, his like extreme philandering, and they weren't sure whether or not they should actually, that he could be a real liability if some of these things came to light. But of course, at the time, celebrities and statesmen, their peccadilloes really were not publicly discussed.
No.
Yeah. So he didn't have that much to worry about. So
it's interesting you mentioned sort of the ethnic resentment that you see a lot of that, like in Philip Roth's work as well.
Yeah.
Directed at women, and he's serving an ethnic agenda. You know, and Portnoy's Complaint, and I think it was Goodbye Columbus as well. He also wrote that one too. Yeah. And you see a lot of in some of the movies of the time, like whether it's The Graduate, which was I think directed by a Jew, written by a Jew, and some of the other comedies at the time, where you have although the character in The Graduate isn't Jewish. He's played by Dustin Hoffman, who is most definitely Jewish. I think the book, it's, you know, he's supposed to be a WASP.
A career in plastic.
Yeah, plastics. And sort of the post-war American, the pressure puts on young kids. As you see a lot in the movie, and fabulously produced and filmed and written, but very subversive, a lot of these comedies at the time. To values, you know, to what we consider the normal values of, Christian values of America. Hypocritical, they're useless, they're passe, you know.
Yeah.
Neil Simon was another one who would write, you know, whether it's The Odd Couple or what was it, The Heartbreak Kid with Charles Grodin. It's none of these things. You I remember watching these movies like late night television, The Late Show, when I was a teenager, and I would watch these movies like they were a bad car wreck, you know, mm-hmm. but not really understanding the subversiveness of these, the subversive quality of this type of humor, you know.
Yeah, well, The Odd Couple as well. I mean, the fact mm-hmm. that you had two divorced men living together,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the whole notion of normalizing divorce, of normalizing fractured marriages and homes. You know, Norman Lear was also a writer for Jerry Lewis, and before he had worked on All in the Family, I think he and Bud Yorkin had put together Love American Style and Divorce American Style.
Oh, the movie, yes, Divorce American. Yeah. I remember it was I think Dick Van Dyke and they portrayed divorce as sort of a lighthearted thing where actually the kids can actually, I think that ends with a reconciliation. I might be wrong, but it shows how kids can actually benefit from divorce.
Yeah. And so, okay, well, divorce and the next step, the next level is abortion, right?
Let's
normalize that as well. It's just like a trip to the dentist office.
And all done, I guess, under the guise, it's entertainment, right? Like Norman Lear would say.
Yes.
I guess you and the article.
At a certain point, up until recently, and when it says that it's we're expressing our concerns.
We're expressing our
concerns. these have been what's that?
Yeah, I said we're expressing our concerns through our control of the media and entertainment.
Yeah. Well, I think that's confirmed, and I attempt to point that out in the article. I think that's confirmed as well in the subsequent activities. Right?
But if say a Christian were to express his concerns, he's a bigot.
Sure. Yeah. Well, isn't he?
Well, based on All in the Family, yes, because that's because all you can end with the argument just singing, singing the Star Spangled Banner or My Country Tis Thee as Michael Stivic storms out the door, right, in rage, but Archie Bunker's bigoted ignorance and irrationality. So, right. Well, I think I've had you. Yeah, we're well over an hour and a half. I think we covered it. I mean.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tim.
So I'll let you go. Again, the article is Our Humor Expresses Our Concerns, Norman Lear and the Politics of Jewish Revolutionary Laughter. It's in the June issue of Culture Wars. Go to culturewars.com, subscribe to the magazine, and read the article. These long form, it's a good way to cover some of these issues because it's not quite a book, but it's not just an article. You know, 1,500 to 2,000 words, so you can cover a lot of ground in them.
And you can't really do anything in 1,500 to 2,000 words.
Yeah,
that type of word limit. I mean, you can get a few points across, but as far as actually documenting something and providing kind of sub arguments or information in the end notes, that cannot be done.
And real analysis, of a topic, as opposed to just bullet points and making a point. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So. But that's for those that with a forum like Culture Wars, they want to sit down and and spend some time taking something in. That's that's what a medium like that is there for.
Perfect. Well, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Tim.
And you have a good evening. Take care. Bye bye.
Okay. You too. Thanks. Bye bye.